From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. While it's nice to think that all that matters is the music, we know that is not true.
I'm stunned that they don't sing live on Saturday Night Live.
Well, I mean, it is, you know, it's supposed to be Saturday Night Live.
Can you say Milli Vanilli?
Today we will talk about authenticity in the music industry and whether it matters now or it ever did for fans. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we discussed potential trauma caused by violent news cycles that involved two on-camera deaths of citizens at the hands of law enforcement. Guest host Adam Ragusa was joined by Kennesaw State University psychologist Roxanne Donovan to talk about self-care.
Do you skip over the videos when you see them? Do you watch them? Have you taken social media vacations?
I particularly avoid the comments, and I use social media in a very prescribed way. And you know, on Facebook, our friends, our quote-unquote friends, may not necessarily be people that we're very close with or that we've vetted or share our opinions. And I just think that can be so very painful when you're trying to use social media as a platform for community and support.
So we asked about your self-care rituals, and here are your first thoughts.
My name is Vivian Vengeesen. I used to be one of those people that had the radio on all the time, but lately I can't take it anymore. I turn everything off, radio, computers, TVs, and I turn my attention instead to my friends, to my family, to making a good meal, to painting, making art. Two things that bring me peace are creativity and being connected to other people.
We love to hear what you think. So call us and tell us what your opinions are and how you take care of yourself. It's 404-500-9457. You can leave a message like Vivian. We're also on Twitter. It's at OSD Talk, or post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comment on the show. The rap song Panda is one of the biggest hits this year, and that's because of a catchy beat and the repetition of these lyrics. But it turns out that shout out saying I got broads in Atlanta, it's not true. 19-year-old Brooklyn rapper Designer created that song, and it turns out he's never actually been to Georgia's capital city.
I've never seen Atlanta. I never smelled Atlanta. I never touched Atlanta.
So, okay. He needed something that made that rhyme work, but it does beg a question about authenticity. Our first guest today says no genre demands more authenticity of its artists than hip-hop. Scott Heath is a professor of literature at Georgia State University. It's good to have you again, Scott. Oh, we're also joined by Joycelyn Wilson. She's an assistant professor of educational foundations at Virginia Tech and a hip-hop scholar. Good morning, Joycelyn. So one of the things we're talking about today is, first of all, the question is setting aside other genres of music, and I mean gospel, soul, every other possible music there is. Do you think that authenticity is different in hip hop than it is in other kinds of pop music?
No, I don't. Because hip hop is part of the Black music tradition, and the Black music tradition has always had the value of authenticity at its heart. So do you understand? So we can't, when you talk about genres, are you...
Well, okay, but when you say it has it as its heart,
it does.
Does that mean that that hip hop is not good? You wouldn't consider a rap song good if the person singing it wasn't telling the truth.
So, okay, the example that you use is Panda and Designer saying "I got broads in Atlanta." He's influenced by Southern hip hop. He is from Brooklyn or from New York, and he is influenced by Southern hip hop in a way that when hip hop was in its formative years, in its golden era, and it was influencing all the other networks like the South, when you think we were influenced by New York hip hop, but now that Southern hip hop has been really driving the music and the genre for the last 13 years. Probably some people would even argue the last 15 years, New York youth, like a Designer, like a new rapper, he is now influenced by Southern hip hop. So for him to say, I got broads in Atlanta,
that inauthentic?
No, it's not inauthentic. It's how it's the exchange between the people participating in the culture and participating in hip hop. That's where the future is the influence of a 19-year-old from New York.
Okay, so let's go to another person who people praise all the time for being very authentic, mm-hmm. and that would be Eminem, famously of Detroit. Let's hear a little of Slim Shady.
Y'all act like you never seen a white person before. Jaws all on the floor like Pam, like Tommy just burst in the door and started whooping her ass first than before. They first were divorced, sewing her over furniture. It's the return of the... Oh, wait, no, wait, you're kidding. He didn't just say what I think he did he? And Dr. Dre said... Nothing, idiots.
So this is kind of another version of the question I asked before, which is, look, nobody denies that Eminem is a brilliant hip-hop artist, but does the authenticity of his lyrics, which appear to be complete unvarnished truth, does that add to critical opinion of him?
Well, truth is one of the key ideals of authenticity. To even, if you're thinking about measuring authenticity, because that's what we're talking about, is something authentic or is it inauthentic? So there's some sort of measurement on that, right? But it's not that black and white. And Eminem is considered authentic to hip hop beyond his race because he talks about his experience. And there's truth in his experience. And people know that there's truth in it. So he is operating and functioning within the key value of hip hop, which is being yourself and being real and being who you are. And if you go against that, then you get Vanilla Iced up out of the culture, or you get Iggy Azalea'd up out of the culture because you did not be who you are. Iggy Azalea would probably still be selling records if she had just been the Australian girl that she was, rather than trying to be like she was from the west side of Atlanta.
Okay.
And sound like she's from the south.
Let's bring Scott into that, because you mentioned Iggy, so let's talk about Iggy. Scott, where does authenticity cross with cultural appropriation?
Well, there's a cultural appropriation, and then there's a appropriation or apparent appropriation of people's stories, people's life stories.
Because Iggy Azalea has been accused of both appropriating another culture and being inauthentic.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the same thing or no?
Well, you know, she's working in a particular genre, and it's a genre whose artists have suffered from a certain expectation, and that expectation is that what these MCs, these rappers, say on record is what they live in their actual lives. And this is something that you know, I think was really cooked up in the 90s, this expectation of the real and keeping it real. You know, and it's an expectation that's placed on hip-hop in a way that it's not... and hip-hop artists in a way that it's not necessarily placed on artists of other genres.
Exactly.
For instance, I don't think Bob Marley actually shot the sheriff, you know? I don't think that
right.
Johnny Cash
Sammy Davis didn't know a Mr. Bojangles,
Johnny
right?
Cash, I don't think, actually murdered a man in Reno, you know, and just to watch him die, right? So, but we expect that when someone's on a record and they say they come from this place, or they come from this experience that they actually have. So bring in Iggy Azalea, who just doesn't fit the script.
And seems to put on an accent that is
absolutely
unreal. But I, oddly enough, and Joycelyn, maybe you have an opinion on this, the other genre, it seems to me, that has similar standards for authenticity is country music. They don't want to know that you're using a country accent only when you're singing country music, or that you didn't grow up.
And I appreciate that. And a lot of hip-hoppers appreciate that about country. That I think that that's where the kind of the lines cross a little bit with country and hip hop. You have country music performers like a Georgia Florida Line, where you can watch them perform. You can kind of see that they are influenced a bit by hip hop. They have some sensibilities, or you have like a Bubba Sparks, you know. So you do have that integration, because that's a generation that has come up listening to the music and connecting with that authentic experience in it.
Let's listen to another very well-known hip-hop artist. Here's Queen Latifah.
The ladies will kick it, the rhyme, it is wicked. Those that don't know how to be pros get evicted. A woman could bear you, break you, take you. Now it's time to rhyme. Can you relate to a sister dope enough to make you holler and scream?
Hey, yo, let me take it from here, Queen. Excuse me, but I think I'm about due to get into precisely what I am about to do. I'm conversating to the folks who have no whatsoever clue. So listen very carefully as I break it down for you. Merrily, 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 high for happy overjoyed. Please, with all the beats and rhymes my sisters have employed. Slick as you're throwing down the sound, totally a yes. Let me state the position. Ladies first, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so Queen Latifah, authentic?
Yes. Definitely.
What makes you say it so definitively?
Because Queen Latifah has always been who she is, who she was on Ladies First. She is. That's why she can go to the Hip Hop Honors and perform that with Moni Love, and you get that same feeling. Because when she performed that, we felt like it was the champion of being Ladies First. She placed women in hip hop firmly, and she has remained the consistent throughout her entire career.
Okay, but Scott, here's where it gets, I think, murky. Because there was a large outcry from many Queen Latifah fans when she lost a lot of weight. Do you know what I'm talking about? That people saw that as her sort of giving in to the pressures of Hollywood and celebrity. Does someone's appearance then add into authenticity?
Well, they questioned her body type. They questioned her sexuality.
Yeah.
I think the appearance does matter, but you know, there's something else about her career, you know, that's interesting. Really demonstrates some of the things that we probably need to let go of as listeners. And what I mean is her transcendence from her performance as a rapper, mm-hmm. and her performance as a I think fairly excellent actor, mm-hmm. right? So you know,
right.
she's reminding you that she's playing
right, because as an actor, totally inauthentic,
right? It's role play. Yeah. You know, Ice Cube is similar, right? He plays a he was one of the premier gangster rappers, you know, of the early 90s, and now he's doing family films, right?
Right.
So it's a totally different guy who loves to smile when he's on talk shows. I mean, it's amazing. So he seems like a really nice guy, unlike the character that he's portrayed on his records. And so I see other MCs, other performers battling with this issue, trying to get out of the role that they've crafted already on record, so that they're allowed to do other things as artists, you know, and
okay, but this brings us then, Joycelyn, to Tupac and whether or not it matters that he was a ballet dancer.
No, it matters because that's part of his experience. Like, I think that
doesn't make him less of the...
Of course it doesn't. It makes him more hip hop. It makes him more of an authentic person. I think that when we look at an Ice Cube, NWA Ice Cube, and now, you know, Barbershop Family Guy, Ice Cube, we're looking at the same person. I saw Ice Cube perform at Coachella this past spring, and he was exactly who he is as an MC. He is playing different roles, and at the core of those roles is that hip hop.
Okay,
Queen Latifah brought that up on her segment on the Hip Hop Honors.
Let's hear a little bit of Ice Cube.
Fresh out of school, cause I was a high school grad. Got to get a job, cause I was a high school dad. Wish I got paid by rapping to the nation, but that's not likely. So here's my application, pass it to the man at AT&T. Cause when I was in school, I got the AEE. But there's no SC for this youngster. I didn't have no money, so now I gotta punch the...
We only have about 30 seconds. We're gonna continue this conversation and bring in other genres as well. But in 30 seconds, Scott, can you address authenticity and whether it matters if Kanye wrote all of his own lyrics?
I think that, again, hip hop gets pigeonholed, right?
Yeah.
It's in hip hop and it's in rap that the artist is expected to have written their lyrics to be expressing original thought in ways that, say, a Beyonce isn't expected necessarily to have written all of her lyrics. She's singing a song, but she didn't necessarily write
those
lyrics.
We're going to get into Beyonce.
and it's different for Kanye West. Kanye, we're reading his tweets, trying to figure out what's really on his mind.
That is Scott Heath of Georgia State University. Joycelyn Wilson is an assistant professor of educational foundations at Virginia Tech and hip-hop scholar. Thanks so much.
Yes.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. So does authenticity matter when it comes to music? Do you care if Beyonce actually made up the story behind her album about Jay-Z's infidelity? And guess what? It's been years since Taylor Swift composed one of her hits on her own. Does that matter? We talked about authenticity when it comes to hip-hop artists. Let's branch that out. I'd like to welcome Elijah Wald back to the show. He's a musician and author of Dylan Goes Electric. Hi, Elijah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we still have with us Scott Heath. He's a professor at Georgia State University. Good to have you back as well, Scott.
Thank you.
So we ended, Elijah, before talking about whether it matters that Kanye wrote his own lyrics. And Scott was saying that in hip-hop that absolutely matters. Does it matter with somebody like Beyonce or Taylor Swift? Does it matter with Johnny Cash or Bob Dylan?
It really, you just gave a long list. Johnny Cash wrote his very early hits, wrote almost none of his later hits. Bob Dylan mostly has written his own things. He sometimes has worked with collaborators, but we know he's a writer. If he wants to do an album of Frank Sinatra things, nobody goes, that's fake. They may go, that's weird.
Well, and Bob Dylan, look, Bob Dylan was born Robert Zimmerman. So, Scott, what about creating a persona, maybe dressing a certain way that you don't in regular life? I mean, does it make Lady Gaga more authentic because she pretty much dresses like that all the time?
As far as we know, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think the dress, the appearance, the public presentation matter so much. And again, it has to do with this idea. Again, I believe it's a sort of a burden that hip hop is, as a genre, and rap music are supposed to do something in a sense. They're supposed to express a particular reality. You know, gangster rap was also called reality rap for quite a while. But again, it's role play. You know, the choosing of, yeah, of garb, the choosing of names. You know, I think this awareness of that and the sort of suffocation caused by that is evident.
Wait,
in some,
suffocation? Why do you say that?
I think it's suffocation, and you see it. You mentioned Eminem earlier.
Yeah.
You know, taking Eminem, who, you know, we know him as Eminem, but we also know him as Slim Shady. He comes, yeah, out with a Slim Shady LP. He comes out with a Marshall Mathers LP. He comes out, you know, again with an Eminem LP and another Marshall Mathers LP. And the idea is that when he takes on these different names, he's taking on different characters, and he's allowed to express something as Slim Shady that presumably he's not allowed to express as Eminem, you know, and it's sort of a tell, right, of his awareness of what's happening in this naming, in this assumption, mm, of particular characters. Beyoncé does the same thing with Sasha Fierce, right? You know, presumably Sasha Fierce sings in a certain way and has an attitude that, you know, regular Beyoncé, I won't call Beyoncé, I mean, she's extraordinary, obviously, but
yeah,
but Sasha Fierce is supposed to do something that Beyoncé doesn't. Rather than just sing these different things, perform tell these different stories as Eminem feels a need to
you
branch
totally
out in his
buy that they can take on characters. Let me bring one more voice into this. Edward Sharp Paul is a music and culture writer. He joins us by Skype. Hi, Edward.
Hello.
Maybe you can weigh in then on this thing with Beyoncé, and in terms of authenticity, whether it matters if Jay-Z didn't cheat on her, if she pulled that wedding ring off and threw it at the camera, and that was all just part of fake drama.
It's a very interesting one. I think the first thing about that, none of Beyoncé's recent moves work if we don't know so much about not only Beyoncé but the way she plays with her knowledge that we know so much about Beyoncé. And I think this is something that we haven't seen much of until quite recently. Kanye's another expert exponent of this. He's aware that we as fans, you want to get, you know, the best popular music leaves a bit of mystery. And as fans, that's maddening. We dive into that mystery. We try to understand the music through the musician. And I think performance, it's right there in the name, performance is performance. This has always been a performative aspect. And I think we're all like little sort of amateur sleuths trying to, I think they know that that's a really exciting aspect of being a fan.
Wait, it sounds like you're implying that perhaps Kanye needs to stop tweeting. Like, do we know too much about Kanye?
No, well, his music, I would say, doesn't really work with that, his tweets half of the time. You know, you need to know every dumb thing he's ever done to get the resonance out of him admitting he's screwed up. I think I think he's really savvy in how he plays with our expectations. You know, gets us offside so he can get us onside with a mea culpa a little down the line. It all feeds this broader narrative of celebrity and music.
So, Elijah, here's a question for you. With somebody like Taylor Swift, for example, it bothers me that she's not writing her own music, and I'll tell you why. Because as a musician, it feels like we've made a lot of dispensations for her. You know, she can't dance. She's not a good singer. She doesn't really play a lot of instruments all that well. So the one thing that she had that she was a really coming out as a young girl was an interesting songwriter writing from her own very young experience. And for me, that changes if these songs are not now her own. What do you make of that?
What I make of that is that you're not a Taylor Swift fan. I mean, I think a big part of authenticity is that inauthentic is something we say mostly about people who we didn't like in the first place. And the people who like Taylor Swift, what was authentic about her was that she was a real girl like them, not a great dancer, not a great singer, not a great instrumentalist. And that was a huge part of her authenticity. It's the vulnerability. And the fact that, I mean, it isn't that she stopped songwriting. It's that she's writing with other people who know some stuff. She's collaborating, which, again, there's a male-female thing here. I mean, women don't see collaboration as falsity.
So, okay, Scott, so when is when is somebody so inauthentic? Is it possible for you to be so inauthentic that it doesn't it impairs the message of the music? And I say this knowing perfectly well that nobody held Frank Sinatra to the truth of songs he wasn't writing.
You know, I think it's a question of the audience and audience need, you know, how badly listeners need these things to be to represent reality. We mentioned Kanye West, we mentioned Taylor Swift, and an example of what I'm talking about is the anger people expressed when Kanye West said in his recent song Famous, it used to be called Nina Chop, on his The Life of Pablo album, he suggests that one day he may still have an opportunity to have sex with Taylor Swift, right?
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, he just he drops it into a lyric, and I think, you know,
well,
most,
he also claimed that he was responsible for her celebrity,
right?
Basically.
So yeah, well, right, and if you know the history and you know that these people have wrestled over that idea, these two artists have wrestled over the idea that they've since apologized to one another, and right, you know, we know the drama. Yet, when Kanye West makes this suggestion in it on his album, people jump to Taylor Swift's defense. They accused Kanye West of misogyny. They, you know, and presumably they had a conversation about it before the song was released. You know this when you read Kanye West tweets, of course. So,
right.
but we want to be angry. We want to be drawn into the story. We want, you know, these things to be real. We want Kanye West to be the asshole that he claims to be, right? We want, you know, Taylor Swift to be. I think she assumes a certain type of innocence as a public figure. People rush to her defense quite often, right?
Yeah.
So
okay, Scott, don't start swearing like Kanye does.
Did I curse?
Edward, this is public radio, man.
Sorry,
Edward. Let me bring you into this because let me go back in time to some of the people like Woody Guthrie, for example, for whom people felt they were very authentic. But again, he himself was writing songs and sometimes singing songs that were not coming from his own real experience. And does that matter when someone becomes an iconic and therefore historic figure?
I think it's
we just lost Edward, I guess. That's what that dial tone means. But Elijah, let me ask you the same question, especially when somebody becomes a part of history. Woody Guthrie helped influence whole movements. So does then authenticity have a heavier weight to it?
It can. And I mean, Woody Guthrie is a good example because there was a huge scandal a couple of years ago when somebody discovered a couple of early songs he'd written that were quite obviously insensitive and racist. And it's suddenly, oh my God, this isn't the Woody Guthrie we loved. For a lot of people, for a lot of the rest of us, it was a Woody Guthrie who was, in a way, more authentic because he was a real person who had, like, come from a racist world in Oklahoma, and not until he was in a different world did he sort of figure out that that was wrong. But for some people, absolutely, the dream, you know, the Saint Woody figure had suddenly become more complicated, and they had problems with that.
So Scott, then what happens with somebody like Madonna? Because she gets criticized a lot for being kind of cold and calculating and strategic in changing her persona. How does that play in with whether or not she's an authentic artist?
You know, I think she does get criticized for being calculating or sort of cold, a little aloof. But she's also celebrated for her capacity to consistently reinvent herself. She's been around for a really long time. We've seen a lot of Madonnas, you know, and she remains relevant, even though sort of recently, you know, she's been the butt of a few jokes that are connected to, I think, unfortunately, her aging and her, you know, her seeming attempt to stay relevant with
a
particular youth.
Let's hear some music here. Since you mentioned aging and whether a woman can authentically age, let's listen to people for whom, you know, there's not as many jokes.
Everywhere I hear the sound of Marvin Jones.
So, Edward, we have you back, right?
Yes, you do.
So let me go to you to talk about this UK invasion here with the Rolling Stones. Mm. I don't think anybody thinks of Mick Jagger as a particularly street-fighting man.
Nor a Delta bluesman, for that matter.
That's exactly where we're going. So let me go back to the question I asked earlier, which is, where does cultural appropriation and authenticity, where do they meet and where do they clash?
Well, that is the question of Western culture, I'd say, right now. The point I was going to make about Woody Guthrie that before I was cut off, I think is relevant here, and that is that I think as long as he was doing justice to the people whose stories he was telling, you'd have to ask the people themselves, but I don't think they would necessarily mind. But that's a very tenuous one with the Rolling Stones. You would have to ask somebody with a little more knowledge of being African-American in America how they feel about their tradition being sort of uprooted. But for the teenagers of America who were the target market of the British invasion, I think you're taking a tradition, you're bundling up in new and strange forms, and it's coming back these mystical beings from across the pond. It's definitely appropriation, but there's a lot of new elements, and obviously it's important to note that the Rolling Stones really lifted their game when they started writing originals. That's when they really took over the world. So I think even they would say the big problem with cultural appropriation is that if it rings hollow, ultimately it's hard to get people excited. And rock and roll became rock and roll truly when it started to develop those extra layers of new and specific context, like the Mercy Beat.
Let's hear a little a little piece of music. Since you mentioned the African American exhibition, let's hear a song that I think would be very difficult for someone who's not African American to get away with.
No more auction block for me. No more, no more. No more auction block for me. Any thousand gold.
So that is Odetta, long known as the voice of the civil rights movement. And Scott, when we start getting into songs like this one, No More Auction Block for Me, but also when you start getting into gospel, mm-hmm. It seems to me like that's another measure of authenticity. It would be very difficult for, say, an atheist to get away with singing gospel, right?
Yes, you know, words like appropriation, that can be a good word or a bad word, depending on what you do with the appropriation. And when appropriation sort of bleeds into the area of exploitation, we have a problem. And the exploitation happens when this borrowing occurs without an acknowledgement of sources, without a citation, I guess. I mean, there's a way to appropriate that actually honors the original, and there's a way to appropriate that either disguises or attempts to discard or somehow deny the original point of origin. I was talking about this some earlier in the week. There's a great podcast called About South, and we've been discussing this sort of the origins of different American musics, and I would argue that a lot of American music is Black American music in its beginnings, right? So in a sense, the appropriative
it's hard
moments
to get away
are,
from it. Yeah.
Yeah, the appropriative moments are only natural in a sense, but I think it's the attempt to dislodge the sound from its origins that's where problems begins to happen.
Okay, well, Edward, let's close this out by coming back to Iggy Azalea, because when I looked up inauthenticity, her name came up over and over and over again. Let's take a listen.
First things first, I'm the realest. Realest. Drop this and let the whole world feel it.
Let them feel it.
And I'm still in the murder business. I can hold you down like I'm giving lessons in physics.
Right, right.
Edward, is this an inauthenticity that crosses the line, that is a bridge too far?
It's, I think not if you take the music at face value, but the tricky thing about Iggy Azalea is the persona she's built around her music. She's proudly Australian and she raps in this hybrid accent. So that's the first confusing thing you've got to negotiate. And then there's her brazenness, which is refreshing, until it gets to the point where you take you know, elder figures in rap trying to talk her through some of the offensive stuff she probably unwittingly does around around race, and she's not willing to have it. So I think she kind of the benefit of the doubt kind of evaporates when you start behaving in that way.
Right. We'll have to end
that. That's what I was talking about with.
Yeah, we'll have to end that there. That's Edward Sharp Paul, freelance writer, Elijah Wald, musician and author. His latest book is Dylan Goes Electric and Scott Heath from Georgia State University. Thanks. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're talking about authenticity in music and whether an artist's authentic music and lyrics matters when it comes to fans. Here to tell us more about the unique challenges to remain authentic is singer-songwriter Sean Mullins. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Also with us is neo-soul singer Joy Gilliam. Hi there, Joy.
Hey, Celeste. How's it going?
Good. It's good to have you as well. You know, Sean, one of the things we were talking about earlier is the similarities in some ways between hip-hop and country. Country and folk music fans don't seem to want people, for example, to use a fake Southern accent. Why is that?
Well, because it's not authentic. I think that would be the case in really a lot of music, but I would imagine you could go to Portugal and find people that are trying to fake it there with a certain Southern accent, you know. I've thought about this a lot. I listened to the first segment. I loved it, by the way. I kept wanting to jump in, though. no, I think, yeah, I mean, I'm not a country music singer, really.
Yeah.
I'm more of a folk. Kind of folk
indie,
acoustic.
Yeah.
But also, I really have a lot of, you know, black musical influences. Everybody from Billie Holiday to Ray Charles to Gil Scott-Heron to, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on and on of all the great black singers and songwriters that I loved, Otis Redding. And so, for me, Gladys Knight's my favorite of all the female soul singers. So I always thought she was really kind of like the Southern Queen of Soul. You know, she's the And all these people were authentic. And so just like Hank Williams and you know, Jimmy Rogers, and I believe that Woody Guthrie was pretty authentic compared to today's music, let's face it. I mean, the guy was singing what he knew about. And that's probably a lot of it, I think, is that even if you're not a songwriter, if you're able to sing something that you can understand and really get behind it and believe in it, you know, Frank Sinatra was not a songwriter, but boy, what an interpreter of song.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe that's the drawing line. And Joy, let me ask.
Yeah,
let me ask you that, Joy. Does maybe the differences in how we treat songwriters themselves who are writing music for themselves and those who are singing others' music?
I think it's a big difference.
Yeah, it is. A big difference, but there are those also who are channelers and who you know, who do a very, very good job of interpreting the music that they come across. I tend to like, for instance, when you introduced me just now, you introduced me as neo soul singer Joy.
Yeah,
I don't even identify with that.
It's hard to describe all the things you do, though.
And it is. But I personally don't identify with that. I feel like I'm a kind of, you know, I'm a funk-based, you know, soul, you know, rock, classical, hodgepodge, goulash.
Yeah, that's a difficult title to give you, Joy.
And it is. You know, it's difficult to you know, to kind of hone in and describe one thing. But I tend to cover songs by artists who have influenced me greatly. And I take it very seriously, you know, being able to run their experience through my filter. You know, the songs and the words that they've written, it's important to me to be able to convey them to people that come and see me, and oftentimes that's their introduction to, you know, to the song that they're hearing, they a lot of times think that I did it originally. Yeah. You know, but that's a compliment of the highest order. That means that I have, you know, translated it in such a way that it was able to touch them and pierce them. And it's because, you know, the person that I heard it from, you know, originally was operating in their, you know, authentic self, and it planted something in me. So, you know, that I wanted to move forward in it as well.
So Sean, when you're writing a song, I think one of the places where fans do seem to balk is when somebody writes a lyric for themselves saying, this happened to me in 1993, and it categorically did not, when they tell what seems like a very personal story that is completely false. And I wonder if you ever have to deal with that in your songwriting, when you're figuring out whether to pretend that something occurred in order to write an emotional message or not.
Oh, that's not an issue for me. I don't even think of that as being, I don't look at that as an authenticity issue. To me, it's songwriting, it's storytelling. Now, sometimes it is a completely true thing that you need to get out. But sometimes, for the sake of the song, it needs an arc, just like a story. It needs something. And what I do, I'm always adding stuff that I have seen in life and witnessed in life and experienced in life. And watched others and listened a lot. And, you know, you observe. And to me, that's just as authentic as writing something that really happened to you. Because I'm writing from a point of character a lot. I mean, like my song Ferguson, I'm telling a story, but it's really about a whole people, an entire race of people in America. And so I'm a white guy doing it. So, you know, how do you, you know, that kind of is a bizarre thing in itself, but to me, I'm a storyteller, and stories need to be told. So
they can't be fiction, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it is, and yes, I do. I have people come up after my show and say, "Well, I didn't know you were from Mississippi," and I was like, "Well, I'm not from Mississippi. I'm from Atlanta, but the character in the song is a 13-year-old girl from Mississippi."
This is a really interesting discussion that can go on, and it's something we would love to have listeners weigh in on. That is Sean Mullins, singer and songwriter from Atlanta, and Joy Gilliam is, let me see if I got this right, a funky punk soul gospel classical singer. Thanks so much to
awesome.
Both of you.
Thank you, Celeste. Thanks, Sean.
Hey.
You know, another place that it's easy to fall back on stereotypes, not just music, but anytime you describe the South, the adult comic series Southern Bastards tries to display more to Southern identity than just what meets the eye. The series set in a small Alabama town where high school football is religion and its coach is the kingpin. The third volume of Southern Bastards comes out today. Co-creators Jason Latour and Jason Aaron describe it to talk about what they call a Southern fried crime series. Jason Latour joins us via Skype. Good morning to both of you.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Good. I mean, first of all, just to continue on the theme of authenticity, do you have to be Southern to write and draw this comic?
This one?
Wow. Yeah.
yeah, I think so, because, I mean, it is our baby, right? Well, I don't know. We had a Do you want to answer that, Jason? Or do you want me to take this one?
No, go ahead.
I guess no, because we do have fill-in artist, our friend Chris Bruner, contributed to an issue of this. But he had lived in the South for a while, and I think that having a perspective on the South probably counts more than actually being from here, if that tracks.
I mean, I guess it does. I mean, I can't separate the two of you by your first name, but
I'm
Jason, if you want to answer the next one. One thing that another way that you described your series was as the ugly. It would be the ugliest show on TV. And I wonder, and that's partly because of the characters that you have. You don't have to hire good-looking actors. I'm reading into what that means, and I wonder if you think do comic readers have a higher tolerance for what you describe as ugliness?
That's a good question. This is Jason Aaron. I'm the writer.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jason Latour, the artist, is actually the guy who populates this book with ugly people, which I think is strangely one of his strengths. He's really great at casting. You know, when you're doing a comic, the artist is not just the cinematographer. He's the entire cast of actors, and Latour is really awesome at that. And yeah, I mean, I don't think of our book as ugly so much as just real. I think there are a lot of real people in this book, real looking people, and Latour is really great at adding the atmosphere to it. But I mean, for me, and going back to kind of your first question about do you need to be from the South to do this book, I don't know that you have to be, but I don't think we would have done this book if we weren't from the South. I don't think we could have come up with Southern Bastards if we didn't grow up where we grew up. You know, if I hadn't grown up in Alabama, I wouldn't have done a story that was about, you know, Bear Bryant becoming the godfather, basically.
And yes, that's actually a brilliant way to describe it. And Jason L., it was interesting to me that you do the coloring as well. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
It's
all sort of a whole.
Yeah. But the coloring, you use the same sort of wash of red in some of the very most violent scenes of the comic that you do for football when they're playing the game. Why?
I you know, without getting too pretentious about it, I think there's a pretty clear link to just emotion, the emotion of anger and how violence is represented hyper-realistically. I think one thing comics do that you can't really get away with as much on television is that we can sort of play with, you're not always constantly in comparison to reality. So like if you're watching television, you are actually, you know, watching real people and real emotions sort of play out. You have a fence post against reality. And when people open a comic, they sort of expect to be transported into something that's a little more direct. And I think that red is a very tricky color because it does sort of elicit a more powerful connection to things like anger and frustration and even effort at times.
So Jason L., staying with football, what does football allow you to do? As a storytelling device, you do a lot with the themes that surround football and how it's sort of taken over this town, and certainly anybody in the South knows football is important. But as a storyteller, what kind of avenues does it open up for you?
You want to handle that one, Jason?
Oh, I thought that one was for you.
No, that one's for you, Jason A.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
We're going to need nicknames.
Yeah.
All right, sorry. Yeah, now I forgot the question. Sorry.
Football. As a storytelling tool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we came into this. Clearly, Latour and I are both huge football fans. You know, I'm a big Alabama Crimson Tide fan, if I can say that on Georgia Public Radio.
You can.
But you know, there's not a huge crossover between sports and comics, so we didn't want this to be a book where you had to love football to enjoy it. You know, if anything, we want this to be a football book for people who don't like football. So, yeah, certainly football is a big part of the action in the book. You know, it is an action comic. It's a crime comic, and football is a big part of that. But we, you know, even if you hate football, we try to show, you know, this is what we love about football. And it's not, you know, there are a lot of bad football films and TV shows over the years, so we're trying to not do that. We're trying to do something that feels like real football. But also, if you don't care about football, it doesn't matter. It's still just a crime comic with that as the backdrop.
So still staying with Jason A., how do you approach the good guys in this comic without turning them into caricatures of a hero?
Well, it helps that there aren't a lot of good guys in this comic. You know, it's called Southern Bastards. Right. You know, the kind of key to what the book was always right there in the title, and that it's really about the bastards. This is about a county where the bastards have won, and that you have this coach, you know, who's so good at coaching football games, he can kind of get away with murder, literally. So we do have a few, you know, quote-unquote good guys who show up, but I don't like stories where the bad guys wear black hats and the good guys wear white hats and everything's very, very clean and clear. You know, this is a book of grays, and So even a character like Coach Boss, who's you know, the bad guy and does horrible things, especially in our first arc, by that second arc, you kind of get a different look at him and sort of see where he came from and how he came to be what he is, and maybe you feel a little bit differently about him.
You don't like him still. But
sure, yeah,
you understand
him
a little
better. He's still an awful guy, yeah, but hopefully you're compelled to see how his story plays out.
So Jason L., tell me a little bit about the setting, because, this is obviously a Southern comic. It even with the art, it doesn't look like it would be anyplace else. But oftentimes you're setting the scene with a gesture. You're not drawing every tree. You're not drawing every dusty road. Why did you choose, in many places, a more minimalist approach?
Well, I think that it's easy to sort of ascribe intention after the fact. A lot of, like, what you do when you're in the moment of a comic, or when you're actually producing a comic, is that you sort of allocate your resources, right? Because it's a very demanding job. So part of the job is self-expression, like finding places to allow yourself to play and to sort of let your subconscious like take over and do things like that.
Yeah.
So I try to approach how the story's sort of directed visually based on like what I think the themes or what is most important about the comic are.
All right. So you prioritized. You're drawing.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's very striking artwork, and the
Thank
story
you.
Is not one that you are reading anywhere else in comics. The series is called Southern Bastards. Jason Latour and Jason Aaron co-created it. The third volume comes out today. Jason and Jason, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
We should note Southern Bastards contains some graphic language and violence that is not suitable for young audiences. That's our show for today. We would love to get your opinion on authenticity in art. For example, when you read something like this set in the South, does it matter if the author is actually Southern? Is it okay for a pop star to create a totally different persona for themselves? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us. It's at OST Talk. I'm on Twitter at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.